Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Libyon Podcast. My name is Jacqueline, and today I am super excited because we have Dr. David Vanderpool here with us, who has written a book, Live Beyond, A Radical Call to Surrender and Serve. And I have asked him if he would mind sharing a few of the stories from his book and a little bit of insight behind it. So, Dr. V, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, you wrote a book, which is an accomplishment in of itself, and I know I'm biased, but it's a really good book.
Well, I appreciate that very much. It was quite an undertaking, especially living in Haiti full-time, but we are glad that it's published and hope people can enjoy it.
Absolutely. Well, today we are going to be sharing some stories from it. So if you're interested, you can go online to livebeyond.org to buy the book. We also have it on Amazon, so feel free to check it out. Again, it is called Live Beyond, A Radical Call to Surrender and Serve. And if you enjoyed this book, would you mind leaving a review on Goodreads or BookBub or even Amazon, just so that other people can read the book as well? But let's go ahead and jump right on in. Would you mind telling us, why did you write this book? What was your reasoning for doing it? Because that's big. That's a big deal.
You know, that's a great question. You know, as we brought team members down to Haiti, we got a lot of questions from people who just simply ask, okay, how did you go from a successful surgeon practicing in the United States to living in the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, trying to help the poor? That was a pretty big step. And so this book basically just chronicles our history and the things that impacted us along the way that really made us turn in this direction. The Lord gave us, we call them stories, they're events with real people, you know, interacting within the story. But He gave us those for a reason, and we can look back on those events or stories, and we can really see how He was conditioning us and guiding us and nudging us, you know, very gently in a certain direction. And so that's what this book is talking about, is how the Lord guided us and nudged us to a spot where we finally jumped off and went to Haiti full time.
Well, in case we have a few new listeners, would you mind giving just a little insight into what Live Beyond is?
Absolutely. We started Live Beyond as a nonprofit back in 2005. And so what the Lord had put on our heart really was to take care of the poor, and really not just the poor, but the poorest of the poor. So In this line of work, we call the extreme poor, that they are people who are barely living. They are barely on a knife edge of existence. They don't have clean water. They don't have enough food. They don't have health care. And so we had done this kind of work before as a family. We'd been, you know, in and out of Africa and Central America and places like that. But we had never really done it in a methodical, programmed, thoughtful way until Hurricane Katrina hit the Mississippi coast, and we went down to try to help and realized that forming a nonprofit would really help us help others. And so we decided to form the nonprofit so that we could get more resources, put them to bear in the hands of the poor so that they could live and thrive in life.
I think that's wonderful. So what kind of programs do you have and where do you specifically work right now?
That's a great question. You know, it's really interesting. We've become a lot more thoughtful about our programs, what the needs are, and how our strengths intersect the solutions to those needs. And so we've actually put together a very good plan for people. And typically, people who are in this lowest tier of poverty all have pretty much the same needs. And so what we have seen is that the bottom tier, the most important part of what they need clean water, they need nutrition, and they need health care. And so the bottom tier of our solutions for this incorporate those three things. And so in the countries we've worked in, Haiti being the most recent, we have really pushed those three things. And we've seen great success with this. We involve the local leaders and governmental leaders in these decisions. They help us along the way. And then we work together to provide solutions for these people who are so needy.
Mm, I love it. Okay, back to the book. So you had mentioned that there were a couple of stories or life events that really changed the trajectory of your life. Can you give us just a little snapshot into what just a couple of those stories were for you?
Well, absolutely. You know, it's so interesting. As we grow up, when we're kids, we think that everybody is like us. We just sort of assume that everybody grows up the way we did. And so I grew up in an affluent family. My dad is actually a surgeon. I grew up going to the best schools and really had never interacted with anybody who was worried about their next meal. That just was not really in my ideas. My family would travel overseas and take care of missionaries. And so missionaries who were sick, my dad and mom and I would go and take care of those missionaries, try to figure out what's wrong with them, and then come up with a treatment plan for them all over the world. And so as a fairly young child, I got to see a lot of different areas of the world that were new to me. And I remember one in particular really hit me. I was about 16 years old, and we had gone to São Paulo, Brazil, to take care of a missionary who was ill. And when we were there, we went through some of the favelas that are there. And these are basically basically what we'd call a ghetto or a very, very poor area. This particular favela was one of the largest in the world, and I had never seen anything like it. It had about a 12-foot concrete wall around the whole thing. And as you went into this, the people were living in cardboard boxes. And I had never seen anything like that. I couldn't imagine that these people were living in cardboard boxes. The favela itself was on a mountainside, so it was a very steep incline that these people were living in. And as we were there, it started to rain. It was about 50 degrees and raining, so it was cold. And I watched as the cardboard boxes that were their houses would actually slide down the hill in the slick mud of the mountainside. And I looked at the people, and they had no idea where their next meal was coming from. They didn't have clean water. They had no access to health care. And they were the poorest of the poor that I had ever seen in my life. And, you know, it just really impacted me that for nothing that I did, nothing that, you know, good that I did, I didn't choose my family. I just was born into a family. I lived in a house that was warm in the wintertime and cool in the summertime, where the roof did not leak. I went to the best schools possible to get the best education. We drove new cars. We had plenty to eat, way too much to eat. It never entered my mind that we would not have a meal. That was never in my reality. But that was the everyday existence for these folks. And I really couldn't shake that image of this hundreds of thousands of people living behind walls that I now realized were keeping them from being visible to the outside. Mm-hmm. It was basically confining these people so that they would stay invisible. Because if you see it, then you have to act. And so these people were behind walls and they were invisible. They were forgotten about. The children who were there were just like children everywhere. except they were just horribly thin, very hungry. I'd never seen anything like that. So when I came home from that summer trip, late summer, and went back to school, it was such a heavy burden that I carried for those people, in realizing that I had really not done anything for them. And it changed the trajectory of my life. I thought, you know, here I have a great education. It's just going to continue. And I want to do something with my life to impact that level of poverty. And as I became a doctor, I started to see other avenues that I could use to exert influence and have hands-on activities in taking care of those people. So that was one of the things that I experienced as a 16-year-old boy that really changed the path of my life. We really started to seek out these people that were extremely poor and that were starving. We started to look for them. We started to go to where they lived and provide them with things that they needed. And obviously, our efforts early on were rudimentary. You know, they were childlike, you know, in nature, and don't even look like what we do now, you know, that kind of thing. But it was a start. And one of the things that I would like to encourage people is to look back in your past, to your stories, and see maybe what the Lord was telling you through different interactions that you experienced as a child or as a young person, that He may have been trying to nudge you a little bit. He may have been trying to get you on a little bit different path, and to open your eyes to things. It's easy to shut our eyes. It's easy to sort of put our fingers in our ears and scream and keep that noise out of our head. But I encourage people to look at their own stories, because that may have been where the Lord was speaking to you, maybe where He was trying to guide you into a different spot.
That's incredible. So you mentioned earlier that Live Beyond, which was originally Mobile Medical Disaster Relief. So if you hear us say MMDR and Live Beyond, or if you read it in the book, that's what it is. They're the same thing, just had a little bit of a name change. But it started in 2005, but we didn't get into Haiti until much later after that. So can you kind of tell us about those years in between? What are some experiences that you had that really helped shape what Live Beyond was going to turn into?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, at Hurricane Katrina, that was sort of our first organized attempt at helping people. And we went down to Biloxi, Mississippi, and the people who were there were just destitute. And this was in the United States. It was just really almost unnerving to me to see people in the United States in sort of looking like a third world country. It was terrible. And so we started assessing the needs of the people. And I think that's very important to figure out exactly what's going on, try to assess the needs, and then come up with solutions for those. And so one of the things that we noticed is the area hospitals had been completely destroyed. The electricity was off. Their generators were underwater. And so they were not able to provide health care to the surrounding people. A lot of the physicians had left the area. The people who were wealthy got in their cars and drove north. The people who did not have cars were stuck. And those were the people who were left down there in just a very extreme, dire situation. So we actually started a little clinic there in the Biloxi area for these people, because they had extreme needs from a healthcare standpoint. A lot of these people received their medications in the mail, and so they may have been diabetic or have high blood pressure, And of course, the mail was not running right after the hurricane mm-hmm. and for quite some time afterwards. And so we this little clinic we supplied, and we supplied them with medical care and medication. It was so amazing. The state of Mississippi actually supplied us with an emergency medical license for Mississippi, which was absolutely phenomenal because it allowed us to treat people, obviously without charge, but it allowed us to do that in a different state under an emergency condition. The other thing that we noticed was that people were going without clean water and food. And so we began to bring and mobilize others to bring food down. We worked with a local church there in Biloxi that opened up its sort of the basketball court that they had on campus and that kind of thing. To store food in, and it became a huge grocery, and people could pull up and groceries would be loaded into their car. And so we started to see needs like that. We actually mobilized other physicians to come down and serve in the clinic, and it ran very well, especially until the hospitals could get back on their feet. Other things that happened during that time were very instrumental in our learning curve. We worked in Mozambique, which is in East Africa, and is just a wonderful place. Very, very poor. We worked up in the northern area with another organization that's just wonderful. And we provided, worked with the organization, provided health care to the local people. One story that we had that we were working with this organization on was a chicken project. We laugh about this project because it's a study in learning how to do this kind of work. A friend of ours was actually in charge of the project. We were just helping out. And so he had been working with this local tribe in this village. They were having starvation issues. And so they were working on a way to let the tribe provide for themselves. And so they hatched this idea. Sorry, that was a bad joke. For them to have chickens. They were actually not layers. They were actually meat chickens. But so they brought chickens into the area. They had trained the people how to take care of the chickens. And the story is pretty comical. Initially, we went in, we brought quite a few, maybe 1,000, 2,000 chicks or something like that into the area. And we had the chicken cages all set up and everything. So we brought them in, talked to the people, said, listen, you know, we're going to let these chickens grow up. They need to get bigger. You can eat, you know, a third of them. You can sell a third of them, you know, and so you can have others, you know, that you can provide for the poor in your area. And so everybody understood. We had, you know, heads nodding all around. So we dropped the chickens off and we went back to the base. The next day we decided to go back and check on the chickens. And so we came back and they had eaten all of the baby chicks. And we're talking about tiny little chickens, a couple of inches bit high. And we said, what happened? I thought you were going to let these chickens grow up and they're going to get big and they'll have plenty of meat, be a great source of food for you. And they said, we're so sorry. We were just so hungry. Mm-hmm. And we thought, wow, this is our fault. We totally messed mm-hmm. this up. The thing is, we weren't very smart. We did the same thing again, expecting a different outcome. We were also a little crazy, obviously. And so we did the exact same thing. We got the exact same outcome. They ate the chicks again. So we decided to switch up our plan a little bit. And we had, as we were bringing the chickens in, we had this enormous feast that we prepared for the people. And so everybody in the village ate until they were about to pop. It was more food than I've seen in one place in a long time. And then we dropped the chickens off and went over the plan again. They nodded in understanding. So that night, we actually got hit by a terrible storm and had 6 or 8 inches of rain and high winds. And my friend and I thought, oh my, you know, I'm sure the chickens have been killed in the storm. So as soon as it dried out enough, we drove back to the village. And we came around the corner and looked, and all the chickens were alive and doing well. And the leaders of the chicken project came up and said, yes, we stayed up with our chickens. We had tarps. We kept our chickens dried. And today our chickens are doing great. And we noticed that it had this project, which was previously our American project, they had taken ownership of. And they were now calling the chickens their chickens instead of American chickens. And that was a light went on at that point. We realized that that was a key to these kinds of programs, is the people have to take ownership. It has to be their program. It can't be something that we're doing. If it's us, then they never take ownership. And so, you know, we learned a little bit. One funny part, ending to the story that's sort of funny, is about a year, or I guess it was about 6 months later, a year, I was back in Mozambique and went to see this village. And as we drove up, the leaders of the village came running out, and they were so excited. They said, you just wouldn't believe what had happened. And they told the story. They were so proud. There was a neighboring tribe that they had actually been enemies with for hundreds of years, probably. And they usually wound up fighting each other. Well, this neighboring tribe was having some of the same issues. They were having starvation issues. And so the leaders of the enemy tribe came to this little village and ask if this village would help them raise chickens so that their children could be fed. So the village elders got with the village elders of the previously enemy tribe, and they worked out a deal. They taught them chickens, and now they're former enemies, now friends. They're working together, making sure that both sets of the kids are being fed and the vulnerable populations are taken care of. And so we said that there was peace breaking out in Mozambique over chickens. So that's sort of a fun story that caps off, you know, the many mistakes that we made going into it, but even more success than we could have ever imagined from that chicken project.
Mm. To this day, that is still one of my favorite stories.
I know, it's funny,
isn't
it?
Just absolutely love it. At that big feast, we forgot a bottle opener. We had like Sprites and Cokes and things like that. And we had so many of them and we couldn't get them off. And so we had to use a seatbelt buckle to pop the caps right off of these Sprite bottles. Oh my goodness. Yes, that's
so funny.
That one still gets me. That one still touches me a lot. So you worked in Biloxi, Mississippi. You worked in Mozambique. What are a couple of the other places that you worked in before kind of settling in Haiti?
Well, one place that we worked was Honduras. And so at that time, we were typically working with other organizations. We had an expertise in healthcare, obviously. And so that was an area that most organizations struggled in. And so we would work together and try to help other organizations build up their health care. And so there was an organization in Honduras that we worked with who asked us to build a medical clinic. And so we raised the money for that and collected all the supplies for that clinic and built the clinic and then shipped the supplies down. And this was an area of Honduras that was very poor and just real close to the Nicaraguan border, sort of on the southwestern side, I guess, of Honduras. And worked with that, got that going, and just tried to assist other organizations like that to help them in areas that we had some strengths in.
Which was such a mutual beneficial partnership. Because while you're, you know, getting to give your expertise in medical care, you are also learning from them what it means to, you know, be there, have a base, boots on the ground, kind of, all of those things. And so I always thought that that was such a fundamental lesson for, you know, you and mom to learn while, you know, that preparation was those seeds were being sown for you then to get to do it a couple years later, which I just think is absolutely brilliant. So, you know, I love your book because you talk so much about all of these different stories, some of the ones you've been telling, and you talk about Ghana and how, you know, by the grace of God, you were instrumental in getting 6 children out of slavery and getting to be a part of that. And, you know, just that story and the redemptive power of Jesus in that and how his hands were so in that. But let's go ahead and jump into Haiti. So can you tell me a little bit about what it was like when you first arrived in Haiti after the earthquake?
That's a great question. You know, just if I can back up a little bit, you know, I was in my office as a surgeon, and there was a TV on, and we saw this terrible earthquake in Haiti on January 12th, 2010. And it was just riveting. It was just one of those things I could not get my eyes away from because of the horror of this earthquake. They were saying, you know, 300, 400, 500,000 people dead, 1 million people injured in a country that at that time had 9.5 million people. You know, so a high percentage. And I just couldn't even believe. It was just hard to grasp that level of devastation. And so, you know, I really at that time felt like the Lord was telling me to go to Haiti and to help out. And so I made some phone calls. I had a friend of a friend whom I contacted who had built a hospital there just on the border, on the Dominican side of the border of Haiti. And he said we could use that hospital. He was very gracious. It's another example of working together with other organizations, and it's just so fantastic. So I came home, and we talked about it around the dinner table, and everybody gave a thumbs up. And so we made the decision to gather our supplies. And 2 days later, we flew to the Dominican Republic with medical supplies. One funny story from that was John Mark and I were going to the Nashville International Airport. We had 11 checked bags between us, each of which weighed 100 pounds. And so we are struggling up to the counter, and lady behind the counter's eyes got about as big as saucers when she saw what we had. And she said, you know, you can't bring that. There's no way. And so I told her what we were doing. And she said, hang on a second. Let me talk to my supervisor. The supervisor comes up and says, absolutely, we'll get these things there. This is great. Mm-hmm. And so we got at least 1,000 pounds, maybe more, of baggage of our own on this airplane going to Haiti. Interestingly enough, that supervisor reconnected with us about 5 years later, and I got to see her again. It was a lot of fun. She laughed about the story too. Fortunately, no one was fired, so that was good. But she helped us a tremendous amount. But as we landed the Dominican Republic, we had rented a vehicle and loaded our stuff up and headed toward this hospital, which was quite a drive. It was a long way through the Dominican countryside. We really didn't have any maps. We were just, going by GPS and hoping we're going to get there. We finally arrived just about as dawn was breaking, and we walk into this hospital, and there are two Dominican nurses there, no physicians, and the floor is covered with people, people who are in agony, who need surgery, you know, broken legs, broken pelvis, chest injuries, just everything possible. And that was sort of our welcome to Haiti was seeing that what we had seen on TV was really true, and seeing this level of devastation, this human devastation, was just unbelievable. But we mobilized our efforts, got organized, got to work, started recruiting other physicians to come and nurses. My wife Laurie and you loaded airplanes up in Birmingham and Nashville and with medical equipment, which flew to us and unloaded in Dominican airports. Just set up a supply chain that was absolutely phenomenal. And this hospital, we laugh, we had 24 operating rooms, which was not quite accurate. We actually had 8 operating rooms, but we could do 3 surgeries simultaneously in each one, which would have violated a bunch of laws in the United States, but we weren't in the United States. So, and we had just tens of thousands of operations done. And so many people were blessed because of the efforts of so many people in America. And it was just an incredible witness to the Haitians and to the Dominicans of the love of God for people.
Mm. So what was that shift like for you and for Mom that, you know, MMDR had been going for 5 years, and it was a disaster relief organization. I mean, it's in the name, Mobile Medical Disaster Relief. So what was that shift like that when you came back from that first trip in Haiti? And if I remember correctly, you were there for about 3 weeks. When you came back, what changed for y'all? What was that conversation like that you said, okay, we need to start going back every single month and keep doing this and partnering with other organizations? But there was more of a sense of urgency that was there. What was that like for y'all?
You know, that's a great question. And it's so interesting because the Lord was nudging pretty hard at that point.
He was banging you upside the head.
He really was. It was becoming very apparent that this was our life's work. And so it was so amazing. I mean, the work is just absolutely exhausting. It's very, very hard. You never have what you need. You have more people to take care of than you have resources. It's very challenging. But the rewards are just, they're indescribable. I mean, it's absolutely phenomenal. And we felt that. We got a glimpse of, we've been given so much. We have just been given so many things. And here these people have nothing. And it really hit us that why? Why on earth were we given these things and these other people were not given them? And, you know, it's so interesting because Paul answers that question in 2 Corinthians. You know, it's just an amazing passage, you know, where he says, you know, that we are given things so that we can share them with others. And it's not that when we have abundance, we share that with those who don't have enough, so that later when they have abundance, they share that with us, so that there is equality. And he uses that word equality. It's a word that's being thrown around a lot right now. It's pretty timely, but Paul used it a long time ago. And I looked at my life and I thought, these people don't have an equal life like I did. I lived in a wonderful place and had the best of everything. That really impacted me that God wanted us to live in equality with people so that they don't suffer. We have access. We share that. And, you know, one of the problems is that has to look like something. That's a real nice thing to talk about on a podcast, but that's gotta look like something. It has a face, it has legs, it walks, it talks, it looks like something. And so what that looks like is giving up the unbelievable excesses that we have and sharing that with people who don't have access to that. And so that was what was dawning on us. And so, as you mentioned, we went back to Haiti every month for a week. I closed down my surgical practice every month for a week, and we went down there. And we thought, okay, this will be enough. This is one out of 4 weeks. We're flying to Haiti. We're taking medical teams. That's going to be enough. And after 3 years, we thought, it's not enough. Mm. It's just not enough. We are still coming back to our wonderful house, with our wonderful friends, our vehicles, plenty of food, plenty of health care. We're still coming back to that 3 weeks out of four. And we saw that equality doesn't mean one out of four. Equality is 50-50, right? Mm. And so we decided at that point to sell all that we had, sell our house. The things we couldn't sell, we had to give away. The things that people wouldn't take, we had to throw away. So we got rid of stuff and to move to Haiti full time. So that transition started back when I was 16, walking through the favelas of São Paulo and seeing people who were starving to death. And the transition occurred in 2013 when we moved down there full time.
Mm. So you went from, in 2005, having a trailer pulled by a truck down in Biloxi, Mississippi, to now having a 64-acre base in Thomas O. Haiti that has farms and a school, a clinic, a church, and just everything you kind of need as well. And so tell us a little bit about what that change was like for you, shifting from, you know, okay, I'm going once a month to now I'm living here and, you know, this is it. Like, this is everything now. So kind of, what was that shift like?
Well, it's difficult to articulate. you know, there are, you can give away your things, you know. It was funny. We had a big fundraiser, and part of it was giving away our silver and our crystal and our, you know, china, stuff like that. And you would watch people. I remember one in particular, watched somebody carry out a big bowl. It was just a big bowl, but it was the bowl that we every Friday night had the big family dinner. It was, we would have bow tie pasta. You remember those days? And that bowl would be full of bow tie pasta, and everybody would be filling their plates, you know, with that. And so that represented a family memory that was a big deal. It's one thing to give away your cars or to give away a collection of guitars or something that you like, you know, but you also have to give away certain things that are iconic, you know, to your family memories. And that's not easy. That makes it pretty difficult. Another thing that is really not talked about, you know, countries such as Haiti, the reason there's so many people living in poverty there is that the country's broken, that the country doesn't function correctly. And one of the things that doesn't function is the rule of law. And so in the United States, we have a rule of law, and people generally follow that rule of law. If you don't, you're probably going to get arrested, right? In Haiti, that's not the case. There's really no rule of law that works. There is corruption and graft. People pay bribes to get away with things. And so if you're attacked and beaten in the United States, they're probably going to find the guy who did it and put him in jail. In Haiti, there's no such law like that. And so if you're attacked and beaten, you just got to get over it. Well, guess what? That's no fun. That is not a fun thing, especially when you're used to the rule of law. So one of the things you give up your wealth, you give up your stuff, but you give up security. And so that was one of the things I really struggled with because I had my family down there. And, you know, giving up security, not being able to ensure just basic safety, it became a real issue. And we've suffered greatly over the last years because of that.
Mm. So tell me a little bit, a few, just a few stories from Haiti, just some little snapshots of your time. Maybe share Maisie's story.
Some snapshots of Haiti. Wow.
We could go on for a while on this one.
We could do a collage. Yeah. We could make a whole...
a gallery wall.
Right. Oh, there's so many. I mean, and they're just unbelievable. So cool the way the Lord works. His faithfulness. You mentioned Maisie. We met Maisie fairly early on. We were going down... actually, we weren't living there yet. We were going down there one week a month. And we had medical clinics that we would put on. And this, we had they were very busy. People didn't have access to healthcare. And so these medical clinics would be just crazy busy, usually set up in a makeshift clinic. And this woman walked in one time in this busy, very busy place. And she was tall and very, very thin. She had a red hat covering on her head. And that indicated that she was a voodoo worshiper. And so when she walks in, everybody in the clinic goes silent because she is a terrifying individual. And, of course, we had no idea what was going on. We just thought, why did everybody all of a sudden get quiet? It's been a riot in here, and now all of a sudden everybody's quiet. And we looked at this woman, and she had some of the most horrific burns I've ever seen as a trauma surgeon on her legs. She comes over, and Laurie, my wife, was running the wound clinic that day. And she comes over and sits down in front of Laurie. And Laurie calls me over. We decide on some cream to put on her legs and a treatment plan. And it was just the most amazing thing. So Laurie is just the most godly woman I know. And so she's ministering the gospel to this voodoo priestess, as it turns out. And Maisie's extremely resistant to the idea. Absolutely resistant. Laurie asks if she can pray for her, and she says no, and she jumps up and run off. Well, the next month, we're back, and so is Maisie. She comes walking in. The burns are, you know, needing lots of treatment. So same scenario. She walks in. Laurie starts putting the cream on her legs and again asks if she can pray for Maisie. And Maisie adamantly refuses, jumps up, and runs out. And so this happened month after month after month. Well, one time she walks in, and the cream goes on her legs. Laurie asks if she can pray for her, and Maisie says yes, she can pray for her. And so they bow their heads, and Laurie is praying for her. And at the end of the prayer, they look up, and Laurie realizes that Maisie has stolen something from her during the prayer. And so maybe not quite as upright as it could
crafty.
Have been.
It's pretty crafty. I mean, you got to give her
it's pretty
credit.
Crafty, yeah. Close your eyes in prayer and steal something, right? And so so this continues on for a long time. So we really befriend Maisie. And we move down there, and Maisie starts coming into the compound. We have a little church, and one day Maisie comes forward and she's baptized into the Lord Jesus. And so we have this voodoo priestess who lives up in the mountains with these horrible burns. She's seen the healing that took place in her legs. They weren't perfect, but they were a lot better than what she had before. because of the cream that was put on her legs. She sees that, she realizes that there is a God, and she rejects Satanism and accepts Jesus. Now, this is a bigger deal than it sounds, because Maisie has been rejected by people her entire life. As a voodoo priestess, the Christians were terrified of her, and so they didn't accept her. Now that she rejects voodooism and accepts Christianity, the voodoo people reject her. And the Christians are a little slow to accept her because they're still afraid of her. And so Maisie really doesn't have anybody at that point. We hire Maisie. She becomes a worker at our base. And we just grow to love her so much. She actually had another child. She had many children. Had another child when she was a believer. And so this baby, you know, was born into a believing family. And just, it's an amazing story of redemption through just the efforts to try to help the poor in any way that you can. As we got to know Maisie a little bit better, we started asking why her legs were burned so badly. And because they were just amazing. Her feet were several inches thick where the burns had built up, calluses on her feet. And then actually fourth degree burns to her feet and legs. So just a terrible burn. And as a voodoo priestess, the way that they worship Satan was that they would walk through fire. And she had walked through fire for many, many, many years. These burns were very old and new. They were chronic. They had, you know, been, she'd been burned very many times because she walked through fire in her worship of Satan. And, you know, this was just an amazing thing that somebody would do over and over, you know, because of their belief in Satan. She came to Christianity and realized that that wasn't necessary to worship God. We did have to offer everything, but the pain of walking through fire was in her background. And so many people came to the Lord just because of her testimony. It was really impressive. But she was a wonderful lady.
Mm. Okay, and one last story. This one, I think, is one of my personal favorites that we've ever had, is the story about Ludie. So would you mind sharing her story?
We had a lady who came to work for us very early on after we had moved down there, who was a young woman, full of life, a big smile, and just really fun to be around. She's just very, very fun individual. And we knew that she was a prostitute in our area. She struggled with that. But we hired her. We want to minister to everybody we can. And the unemployment rate is 80% in our area. And so hiring people is one of the best ways that we can minister to them. So this young, funny, very affable woman came to work with us. And she was always sort of, you know, the life of the party, always had funny jokes to tell and things like that. And we have chapel every weekday at Live Beyond, and then church on the weekends. And so the people come to chapel. She would come down and fall at the front of the chapel weeping because she wanted to give her life to Jesus, but she said she just couldn't. And this went on over and over and over. She'd come to church on Sundays, and she would just fall on her face crying so hard because she couldn't give up her life and life of sin. And we just sort of thought she needed the extra money for prostitution, you know, whatever. I didn't really know. But we loved her, and she worked for us, you know, for years. Several times on Friday, she would say, "Okay, now Sunday, I'm going to come forward. I'm going to profess my faith in the Lord and be baptized." And I said, "We'll be ready for you. You just come on down." And she wouldn't show. And so one Sunday, she hadn't mentioned that she was going to come. We actually had a team of Christians from the United States there that Sunday. And I look up and I see her coming through the gate. And she's walking to church. And so I thought, this is going to be great. So she comes in. She comes forward at the invitation. And she's crying and weeping. And she said, today's the day I'm going to give my life over to Jesus. And I want to be baptized. And so one of the things that we do in Haiti, it doesn't happen in the United States too much, but is people confess their sins. That they come forward, they confess their sins, and they repent of those sins in front of everybody, and you know, then they're baptized. And so she starts telling her story, and her story's in Creole, and so we're translating her story. And she starts talking about it, saying that she was a prostitute. And of course, all the Haitian men in the audience sort of nod their heads. You know, everybody sort of knows her. She's a prostitute. And then she says something that I didn't know. And it absolutely shocked me. She said, I was the prostitute for the voodoo temple. She was a temple cult prostitute. Now, it's sort of the same at the end of the day, but that's a big deal because she had taken a blood oath that she would always be the temple cult prostitute for the voodoo temple. And the voodoo priest says, if you ever renounce this, I'll kill you. That you took a blood oath and that I'll kill you if you do. So she came forward and renounced her voodooism as well as being a prostitute, full well thinking that she was going to be killed. That was the piece that I missed, but that was the main piece that was keeping her from becoming a believer. So that day she confessed her sins, that day she repented of her sins, and she was baptized into the Lord Jesus that day. And as she came up out of the water, the most amazing thing happened. I've never seen this before. She shrieked. I mean, she let out a yell that could only be described as a shriek, and then fell back face first into the baptismal. Now, the baptismal was just a big concrete trough. It was nothing fancy, but she went face down back into the baptismal. I was afraid that she was going to drown. She wasn't moving. So I picked her up out of the water and raised her up, and she was just out cold. It took a minute for her to really sort of wake up and open her eyes. And it was the most dramatic baptism I think I've ever seen. She was completely delivered from her past. Everything that she had done had now been lifted off of her. One of the pastors that was there with the American team came up to me later and said, you know, I think she was delivered from a demon. I said, yeah, that may have been what was going on. It's hard to tell. But, you know, she was delivered from the power of Satan, and she came to full belief in Jesus. She sits on the front row of church. She sings her heart out. Her kids are there. She is living a righteous life, and that transformation is just so dramatic, and it's known throughout the entire area that's what her transformation meant, and the testimony is probably still being told this many years later.
I love that story so much. Makes me cry every time. It's such a good
It's a good one.
Well, all of these stories, and even more, are in your book. And it truly, truly is incredible to see the way that the Lord has worked in your life and is working in Haiti, and just the ways that we get to be a part of it. It's just so exciting and such an honor. My last question for you is, what is your hope for people to get out of reading your book?
That's a great question. You know, the book is there to inspire people. You know, it's just a story about a regular old average guy, you know, that the Lord prepared works for in advance, that the Lord constantly nudged into the direction that he wanted him to go. It's not a superhero book. It's just a regular guy that makes lots of mistakes, you know? But that's what I want people to see, that this is everybody. This is the story for everybody, that the Lord has got a life that he wants us to live. And that life is the best life possible. There is nothing better than this. I have to tell people, I had a very enviable career as a surgeon, but what I do now is so much more fulfilling than what I did before. It's not even in the same league, because I'm walking in the middle of the Lord's will. He wants me to do this. Doesn't mean I don't blow it. I blow it all the time. We make mistakes all the time. But he wanted me, he prepared me specifically from interactions and stories throughout my life that prepared me for what I'm doing now. And it's amazing that we serve a God that loves us that much, that he would pour all these resources, all this time, all this energy into a regular old guy just to try to get him to a certain point to go to Haiti, go to the West Bank, go to other places in the world and take care of the poor. But he did. And he'll do that for every single one of us. That's what the book is about, is that we all have this life that the Lord wants us to live. We may not be living it, but he wants us to live it, and he'll do anything to get us to live that life.
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much for sharing some of your stories. This was such a treat, and I'm just so grateful. So thank you for joining me today.
Absolutely. Hope people enjoy the book. It's available on Amazon. Would love for you to read it, and if you like it, give us some feedback on it. We'd love to hear about it.
Well, if you are interested in learning a little bit more about Live Beyond, you can go online to livebeyond.org and check out all of our amazing programs. We are so grateful for the ways that we have been able to partner with the Lord and in the transformation of Haiti to look more like the kingdom of God. So please feel free to go check that out. Again, please go buy the book. It's absolutely fantastic. But I think that is it for today. I hope you have a wonderful day, and don't forget to go out and live beyond.